This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The world's gotten itself into a lot of trouble, and it's us humans that are pretty much to blame. The global challenges that humankind is facing, among them climate change, overpopulation, health issues, the gap between rich and poor, status of women, the list goes on, and all of these need addressing and fast. Professor Dr. Ilesi Gerbers-Huber, a professor of physics and an expert in nanotechnology, biomimetics and tribology, feels that the solution lies in connecting different scientific results into a wider understanding of nature and its developments. How exactly do we do this? She joins me to explain how. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Professor, like I mentioned, you are an expert in nanotechnology. When and why did you feel it was necessary to connect all these different scientific results into a wider understanding of nature and then its developments?
Well, you know, when I was still back in Austria, in Vienna, I was working as a physicist in a nanotechnology research laboratory, and we had very, very cool microscopes. So we were watching the tiniest structures in nature, and we were learning how they interact and how they build up larger structures. And actually, if you look at these nanostructures, especially in living systems, you can see that you have levels of hierarchy. So when you go up from the nanoscale, which is really, really tiny, you know, if you look at a hair, the diameter of a hair is 100,000 nanometers. Mm-hmm. And so nanotechnology is technology which takes place on this very, very small scale. So if you go up from the nanoscale to the microscale, which is 1,000 times larger, to our normal macroscale, you know, 1 meter is 1,000 millimeters, 1 millimeter is 1,000 micrometers, and yes. 1 micrometer is 1,000 nanometers. When you look at living nature, you can see that actually on the nanoscale, on the microscale, and on the macroscale, you have functionalities, and you have added layers of functionalities which are interdependent and interconnected. And so I started out as a scientist working in a very, very small areas and investigating these structures and assigning a structure and a function to what I see. And then I realized that actually, if we look at living nature, it's all dependent on each other. Mm-hmm. And the big, beautiful system which we can see at the moment outside with plants, with animals, with people, with this amazing cycle of life is based on the nanoscale and on functionalities on the nanoscale. So I understood this, and then something happened to me which was very, very important in my career as a scientist. I went to the European Forum, ALPACH, to the technology talks, and there I heard a man talk about global challenges for humankind. And for the first time in my life, I saw somebody who was actually dealing with the big, big problems. And, you know, as a physicist, before, I never thought that I could even dare to address such big things, that one person can even start to think about such big things. But I gave this issue some thought, actually over many, many years, and I realized that this is the only way we can address such big, complex problems as the global challenges, because actually they are not sitting in one specific field of expertise. They are not just based on physics or on chemistry, but they are based on, you know, on everything which we have outside. So to address these global challenges, we also need to understand these big trends, these big developments, which do not care about, you know, specialist areas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how exactly can we address these challenges then?
Well, I think what first needs to be done is we need to develop a deep understanding of complex systems, mm-hmm. and of emergent properties.
Okay.
With emergent properties, I mean, you have many, many constituents who are doing tiny little things, but the outcome is much bigger than the sum of the parts.
Of course.
One example for an emergent property would be our consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
If we think of our brain being made up of neurons, you know, which have two states, either the fire or not, so 1 or 0, but of this activity, of these single neurons, which are a little bit cross-talking to each other via chemistry, out comes something like consciousness. Right. And there can be wonderful things coming out, and there can be dangerous things coming out, you know, like a major change in climate, for example, like a major reversal of some processes on which we are dependent. And this is, of course, for us as people, not the situation we want to be in. So the basic message is we need to increase our understanding of these global challenges. And for understanding of the global challenges, we, of course, need the input of specialists, you know, who research the single items in depth as much as they can. But we need people who connect the results and who are able to communicate the results also to people from different fields. Because actually, you know, not very many crosstalk across disciplines takes place.
Exactly.
So the biologist talks to the engineer, talks to the architect, talks to the air chemistry person, and so on and so on. And actually, we all need to sit together and to talk to each other and to talk in a language which we can understand across fields.
Right, rather than using a lot of jargon that nobody really quite understands, which
yes.
is specialized in their own sort of fields, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, and so you've taken nature, actually, as a perfect example of how this collaboration goes on.
Yeah, so if you look at living nature, you have a perfect example for sustainable system where the parts are interdependent and interconnected, and even more where the output of one system, like the waste, is the input for another system in terms of food or in terms of fertilizer. So it all works in a big circle with not very much garbage. Somehow the system keeps itself
alive. It's sustainable.
Alive.
Yes.
It's sustainable, yes, yes. So if we want to address our problems, which arose mainly from our actions, from not understanding the big picture, we can learn from living nature how this can be done. And so I think it's very important to watch, to think, to try to understand the deep principles of living nature, and then to do the transfer to science and engineering, sociology, how we live together, how we do things together. And this is, of course, a hard thing to do.
Okay. And you've taken to the rainforest, actually, to come up with solutions for this.
Yes, you know, the Malaysian rainforest is just a wonderful place to go and to learn because we have all this high biodiversity. And when you sit there and when you watch, you know, the plants, the animals, the interactions of them, you start to understand that it doesn't make very much sense just to look at one isolated organism. You have to also understand the ecology of the whole system. And I think by a basic shift in the way we are thinking about our technology, about our education, about how we are doing science, we could reach a sustainable system as human beings.
Coming up, we'll find out from Professor Ile how specific examples from nature give example to this. Here on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture and I'm Juliet Jacobs. I have with me Professor Dr. Ile Gerbers-Huber. She is a professor of physics and an expert in nanotechnology, biomimetics and tribology. And she is discussing how we can address humankind's current global challenges through a different way of thinking. Now, Professor, you propose a collaboration, a synergetic approach, combining linear Western thinking with more holistic Eastern approaches. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I think the linear way of doing things, of doing science, for example, Western science, is very successful and also brought the world to the stage where we currently are. But I think it also induced a lot of problems which we have to address. And there's a famous quotation by Albert Einstein who said that you can actually not successfully address the problems with the same way of thinking that was used when you created the problems.
Yes.
So the idea is to look around the world for different ways of thinking, for different ways of doing things, and for different ways of approaching problems and living your life. And, you know, me coming from Austria, from a small country in Europe, I thought, well, it might be nice to go to a country where everything is completely different. So we chose Malaysia, a tropical country, an Islamic country, a country with very many different peoples living here, with different religions, with wonderful modern cities, with big optimism, great development, and on the other hand, perfect and wonderful nature. And all this was made by people from Malaysia and by people from Southeast Asia. And I think to address the global challenges, we will need different ways of thinking, and we will need to fuse these different ways of thinking to a new way of approaching life, approaching science, approaching engineering. And so the linear Western way, I think, of doing science, of doing engineering, it would benefit very much from combining it with this more holistic, integrated approach, mm-hmm. which I see in Asian countries.
Okay, and you see it specifically also in a lot of nature, a lot of fauna found in our Malaysian rainforest. For example, you use the Raja Brook butterfly as a mean to study material structures and processes.
Yes, so if you look at nature, at living nature, you are absolutely overwhelmed by this integrated multifunctionality of what you can see. Mm-hmm. You can see this multifunctionality in the materials, in the structures, and in the processes. Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned Raja Brook's birdwing, national butterfly of Malaysia. Well, it's a beauty. It's yes. just so, so nice with its green structures, with the black. And actually, if you look at the wing, it serves so many different functions. We haven't even started to identify all of them. One of the functions, of course, is the nice, beautiful coloration, which helps it in its camouflage. Mm-hmm. It looks like the tips of plants, like the tips of ferns. So it looks like it's a piece of a plant and not interested for predators to eat. But there's much more in this wing. There is, for example, a function built in which causes the raindrops to run off in a certain pattern so that the fragile parts of the butterfly are not reached by the raindrops. Right. The third functionality we have already identified is exquisite temperature regulation. So for the butterfly to be able to fly, it needs to be above a certain temperature so that all the muscles and things are working so that it can fly. But it can also not be too hot, because if it were too hot, the proteins would disintegrate. And especially in such a hot country as in Malaysia, of course, this temperature regulation is very important. Yes. And now you have this big amount of black, and you would imagine, you know, a black butterfly must be boiling after 2 hours. But actually it is not, because of this gorgeous temperature regulation. And there are many, many, many more functionalities in this wing. And actually what touches me so much and what causes the interest to do biomimetics of this butterfly wing, but biomimetics being learning from living nature for the engineering application. So what is the reason for us to do biomimetics on the butterfly wing is that if you look at the material of this wing, mm-hmm. it's not very specific, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just like keratin, like our fingernail material. Yeah. So the magic is in the structure and not in the material. And I think alone from this fact, we could learn a lot for our engineering applications. Because if we are building things, for example, here in the studio, I have all the metal holdings of the microphones. I have all the devices which are made from metal, from plastic, from wood. And just imagine where the material of all the things are coming from. are coming from. The metal is mined somewhere, I don't know, in Siberia, in the USA, and it's transported over thousands and thousands of miles. The plastic comes from the hydrocarbons, yeah. You know, from the oil, petrochemicals. And so the constituents of one of these microphone holders come from many, many different places of the earth. Whereas if you look at the butterfly wing, everything is locally harvested, and it's just a couple of materials where the functionality is brought in via the structure. And so one of the things I would like to advise future engineering to look into is to build more with structure rather than with material. It might be more expensive in the beginning.
Exactly, which is what they will say.
Yes, because we have no idea how to make such elaborate structure. You know, the butterfly grows by itself, yeah. Which is a miracle again, you know. If we found out how to grow things which we need, how to grow an iPhone, it would just be perfect. How to grow an iPhone with just local constituents from your garden. But I think that's a way to follow. It might sound like science fiction, but we have a working system which shows us that actually it is feasible.
Okay.
If you look at the trees, if you look at the plants, and they have amazing structures, the teeth which can bite through, you know.
Yeah. So what you're proposing is like a whole complete change in mindset, a whole complete way of doing things, almost.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you read the scientific journal Nature, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, you are reading very, very frightening report about the state where we brought our Earth to. So one of the things I read last year was that we are now approaching the 6th mass destruction of species.
Species, yes.
Which is defined that 80% of all the species die out. The last mass destruction, extinction of species, was 200 million years ago. And this one is the first which is induced by people. The second paper, which was just published a couple of weeks ago, is that the Earth is actually reaching a tipping point. So the situation, the environment for us will completely, completely change. And I think we are seeing small first signs around the world of the biggest catastrophes coming up.
They're not that small, actually. They're actually quite big signs.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But we haven't yet connected them in a bigger picture. And I think we cannot address them by doing localized small actions, by not using plastic bags on Saturdays. This is a nice thing, but it doesn't solve the big, big problems. So I think we have to, you know, also reach a change, a complete reversal in our ways of doing some things, which might be very beneficial and might be very good. If we have smart people who think about the ways of doing things.
It's very nice to say it in theory. How do you think, how practical do you think it will be? Do you think people will actually, because I mean, all of us know that the world's in trouble, but still we pollute, still we do all these bad things. How do you propose we actually create more awareness and get people more involved in doing such things?
I think one of the most important approaches is education of kids. I think, you know, the young ones are the future.
Yeah.
We have our established, you know, ways of living, ways of doing things. When I posted on Facebook that our mobile phones in certain frequency bands are killing the bees, a lot of my friends said, well, I love the bees and I want them to stay here, but I'm dependent on my mobile phone. I can't change. So I think the future is the youngsters. And if we give the youngsters a solid and good education, which is based, you know, on understanding, on seeing the connections, on seeing the trends and the developments, and which is based on responsibility, so that the people know that they themselves are responsible for the future and they can actually contribute to the future and help to address problems, then there will be an optimism and there will be a drive to change things. And you know, that's another thing why I am here in Asia. Because here in Asia, I see this huge optimism of people. We can do it. We can change it. We can address it. And one more thing which I see here, I just said the same thing to our Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research and Innovation at UKM last week. What I see here is that people can learn. If they find out that something which they did over 30, 40 years is wrong, they are able to switch the direction, which is very hard in some other countries.
Well, that's very promising to hear, because, you know, we would think here that with our developing status, we would do anything to get to that status of developed, regardless of what's happening to nature. Do you know what I mean? In terms of development and everything. So for you to notice an optimism, that is something quite promising, actually.
Yes, this optimism, especially in Malaysia, is one of the things which keeps me going and which keeps me acting. It's wonderful.
Could you give me an example of this kind of optimism that you've sort of witnessed? Because I know you're working with students.
Yeah.
Taking them to the rainforest as well. And these are students from different fields, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Well, for example, I have two Malay girls. Mm-hmm. One of them is from biology. One of them is from engineering. Mm-hmm. And they have been friends for many, many, many years. And they are now both doing their PhD with me. And actually, you know, when I got the biologist into my team, she was very, very much in her biology language and doing and, you know, thinking. But because the engineer is her personal friend, they could establish this joint language and they are now talking to each other. And actually, in the beginning, it was very hard for both of them because the concept of biomimetics, to learn from living nature for engineering, was completely new for them. And the biologist didn't quite know what she can bring in. The engineer didn't quite know what she can bring in. And when we go on rainforest expeditions, when we went to Ulumuda last time in the north of Malaysia, very, very nice. We still have tapirs there and elephants. And
it's quite untouched, right?
Yes, quite untouched. Pristine forest, beautiful, beautiful. And not just beautiful, the engineer was there and her eyes got bigger and bigger every day. And, you know, the talking with the biologist changed and they both approached nature in this very, very functional view. So they were really trying and successfully trying to learn from what they saw there for their future joint approaches. And now to come back to the optimism, I asked them, I told them, well, there is an international conference with representatives of 20 countries. Do you dare to go there? And do you dare to give your first scientific presentations? And both of them said, yes, we're going to do it.
Wonderful.
And they went there and they gave the presentations, the first presentation at an international conference. And both of them won an innovation award.
Oh, there you go. That's wonderful.
The only two innovation awards that were given away to people at this whole conference.
And the two girls got it.
Yes. So, you know, they were convinced. They were optimistic. They were saying to themselves, we can do this. We can talk to the people. There were people from Nepal, from America, from France, from Europe. From Germany, from you name it. And they were giving the presentation, they were presenting their research results, and they were awarded with big, big, nice things. So that's the way to do.
And so obviously they are going to take that and they are going to come to tell other Malaysians and the world how we can together change things.
Yes, exactly. And all this happened in 1 year.
Wow.
So they have just, you know, working on their PhD for 1 year. So this confidence, this optimism, this, you know, it's hard, but if we work hard, we can, you know,
you can
realize it. We can do it.
So there is hope. There is hope for all of us.
I think there is. And I think, we have to address it. We have to approach it.
Just going back to what we were talking about earlier. So, Professor, what other examples can we find from nature to use as a means for sustainable and interconnected living?
Well, for example, the two architects with whom I'm going to Tasik Bura in a couple of weeks, they are looking at plants and at animals concerning shelter. How do plants take shelter? How do animals take shelter? How do they, you know, remove themselves from the environment and are protected, mm-hmm. and how can this be transferred to architecture? And one of the things which we can, again, wonderfully see in Malaysia is the traditional way of building houses. So if you look at Orang Asli houses, or if you look at the traditional Malay house, you can see that without fans, without air condition, you have very, very nice ventilation yes. inside. And it's built on stilts, you know, to protect against the insects and many, many other functionalities in the house, which the people who were that time when the houses were built very, very close to nature already learned from nature, yeah. especially in the Orang Asli houses, you can see this. And the architects are going to bring this even a step further, because they are looking at functionalities which people might not connect directly to architecture, mm-hmm. but which nevertheless can be very, very inspiring. One example is, for example, the glass wing butterfly, which has transparent wings, and they are learning from these transparent wings for new applications in transparent materials in architecture. Mm-hmm. And they are not just transferring the transparency, they're also transferring the underlying sustainability of these materials.
What is the underlying sustainability of these creatures exactly?
Well, you know, the materials, they would disintegrate very fast,
right?
And they can be tuned to the specific functionality. So you use one material mm-hmm. and then you tailor it to your specific application.
Right.
For example, if you look at us, I already mentioned the keratin of our fingernails. Yes. It's a very similar material to the cornea of our eyes,
yeah.
which has, you know, two completely different tasks to fulfill. Yeah. And so nature is in many cases using just a couple of base materials and then slightly modifying it mm-hmm. for the applications. And this, of course, would be interesting for architecture in terms of, for example, waste disposal. If you want to remove one of the houses, you wouldn't have 20, 30, 40 different materials. You might just have 4 or 5 different materials, which are differently structured.
Yeah.
But the structure, you know, in the recycling process doesn't influence very much. If you want to reuse it for a different material, you could melt it down
yeah.
and you could build another structure. So it's this reusability.
Oh, it's also
which can be.
Sorry. You know, modular housing, as in you use the same materials, but you can enlarge, you can expand, you can completely bring it down and push it somewhere else if you plan to move. Is it that sort of thinking as well?
Yes, exactly. So this is many of the this comprises some of the thoughts that the girls came up with in the last weeks.
Wonderful.
Very so exciting.
Lots of things then going on. In conclusion, Professor, why is diversity so important as an input to the engineering sciences?
I think that if we look at living nature and if you look at the huge biodiversity of animals, plants, microorganisms, we can see that for a functional system, for a sustainable, functional, interdependent, interconnected system, it needs a big diversity of the single parts so that the whole system is working.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from this we can learn for engineering that also in engineering, we need diverse approaches, we need niche approaches, we need mainstream approaches, and all of them need to act together to build up a functional, good system for the future.
Yes, so basically everybody just really needs to work together.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Professor, for joining us. That was Professor Dr. Ilesi Gerbers-Huber. She is a professor of physics and an expert in nanotechnology, biomimetics and tribology, talking to us about different ways of addressing humankind's current global challenges, using nature as an example. Here on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.